So I'm Eliza Griswold. I'm a Schwartz Fellow at the New America Foundation, and I have a forthcoming book called The Tenth Parallel, Dispatches from the Fault Line Between Christianity and Islam, which will be out in September from Farrar, Straus & Roux. And I'm speaking to Dayo Olopade, who is a fellow, Schwartz Fellow. And what else, Dayo?
And I'm a political correspondent at TheRoot.com, and very pleased. Congratulations on your book. I'm really happy to be speaking to you today. We have a history, actually, in that we've met, but not in a time that I could remember, back in Chicago.
I'm outing it, Dayo. I'm going to out it on this national television program and say that Dayo and I met when she was, I'd say, roughly 4 years old. We had an intense political conversation about whether or not I could hold her or not, and I believe she concurred on that, and I did, in fact, hold her when she was a tiny baby.
But this is really exciting. I'm incredibly pleased. I followed your work for a long time, and I think this is such a relevant moment to be talking about the role of religion and culture and politics, particularly in Nigeria, which is, you know, my parents' home country, and where you've spent a lot of time. And it's been thrust back into the headlines in a sort of unfortunate way in the last few months, most recently because of inter-ethnic, religious violent conflict in central Nigeria, in the town of Jos and in some of the villages surrounding it. And most recently, there was an attack on a set of villages where estimated 300 to 500 folks were killed. And this is sort of an ongoing problem, tension between Christians and Muslims in that part of the country. But I want to hear your take on, one, if this is, you know, something that history being doomed to repeat itself, or an isolated incident that we can hope, you know, leads to reconciliation in future. What's your take?
My take is, I mean, I think the first thing we need to do is back up a little bit in terms of the context of the contemporary violence, because this has, obviously, as most conflicts do, a long historical narrative. And it begins really before European and particularly British colonial history, which is this area lies at the edge of what was traditionally Muslim North Africa. And the people who are now Christians who live in this area were traditionally ethnic minorities who lived at the edge of this greater Muslim community and were frequently enslaved by the dominant culture. I mean, they were, and they, so they fled to this place. Jos is in what's called Plateau State, which comes from that. That name is because it sits on a, right, on a plateau, on a relatively high swath of tableland where ethnic minorities have historically fled to protect themselves by seizing high ground. So traditionally, the people who live in this space are ethnic minorities who fled to the space to protect themselves from enslavement. When the European colonial expansion and arrival really arrived in Nigeria in the 1800s, along with them came Christian missionaries, and a lot of these minorities eventually, although they were originally hostile to the arrival of Christianity, eventually adopted Christianity as a form of liberation from basically what they would say as Islamic oppression, cultural, right, and political oppression.
Right.
So that's the history here. And then what's happened with contemporary Nigeria is really looking into the 70s, 80s, and particularly in 99 with the end of the military regime,
right,
religious identity in particular, and in particular in this space, because this lies along, just lies along the 10th parallel, at the space where Christianity and Islam meet not only in Nigeria, but across much of inland Africa,
right,
with primarily a Muslim north and a Christian and non-Muslim south, with several large exceptions, including Nigeria's southwest among the Yoruba people. But
right,
so in this space, these two religions meet. And what's happened is that longstanding ethnic hostility has basically been, religion has been grafted onto these larger questions of who has the right to dominate. Now,
right,
Jos is the capital of Plateau State, so there you have now a Christian majority. And Dayo, I don't know how much you have covered the question of indigenship. And is that something that you are familiar with growing up, the question of who has the right to land and political power? In the Nigerian Constitution?
Well, I just, it's fascinating to me. I'm not particularly familiar with the sort of the text as it's written, but my understanding of the political coalitions has always been that power sharing, it's sort of a gentleman's agreement over the years that Muslim and Christian Nigerians of all ethnicities sort of pass power back and forth. And we saw that when the former president Obasanjo left in 2007, that power sort of transferred to the north. Because Obasanjo was, you know, a southerner. And I'm very interested in hearing from you how closely all of these questions overlay with the idea of nationalism and the idea of the economic agenda. Because obviously the people who are perpetrating some of this violence are very young. Half the country is under 20 years old. Folks who might not have other opportunities, and we're seeing this replicated, you know, obviously it's not just in Nigeria, but in places where the U.S. has significant interest as well. You could talk about Afghanistan that way, you could talk about Yemen that way, or Somalia. And so I'm wondering, given the economic history of slave trading and of resource interests that overlays with this ethnic conflict, how important you think the religious component is as it compares to the economic component, or the, just the straight idea of political power and who gets to rule?
Very good questions. I mean, the first being in terms of power sharing, at the federal level, you're absolutely right. When it comes to the presidential election, Nigerians, typically it is a gentleman's agreement. Presidents shift from north to south, Christian to Muslim, without too much problems. Because the problems really aren't on the federal level. They're at much, much more at the local level. And that really, that's where economics becomes a huge question. Because just as some simple facts on Nigeria, being Africa's most populous country with a population of 140 million people, roughly one in six Africans coming from Nigeria, my Dio included originally. And then on top of that, the idea that here is an extremely weak state, right? And my, okay, so what I've been doing for the past 7 years is traveling along this space where the two religions meet, not only in Nigeria, but also in Sudan, Somalia, Ethiopia, and then in Southeast Asia, looking at Indonesia, Malaysia, and the Philippines. But each where religious violence seems to break out is paradoxically in democratic states and definitely in weak democracies.
Right.
Because when a government fails to address the needs of its people, those citizens turn to other forms of collective identity. And more than race or even ethnicity, in what I've been seeing, people turn to religious identity. And the economics are such in a place like Plateau State. I mean, the government being a citizen of Nigeria means nothing. I mean, no guarantee to certainly school, which you have to pay for, if that's even an option, electricity, water, roads. You know, so when the state fails to guarantee the rights of its people, people turn to other forms of collective identity to safeguard those rights. And more than any other, especially in mixed communities, they turn to religious identity. So that's certainly what I've been seeing in Nigeria. I mean, having worked extensively in Afghanistan and Pakistan and, you know, and Yemen, I think the parallel is pretty different, because I think what you're seeing is people finding a new source of global identity. And religion, there's an openness, basically I would say there's an openness in countries like Nigeria that actually leads to greater competition, because they're so fraught and they are choosing a history in opposition to colonial history. I mean, for example, in the Islamic north of Nigeria, if most people, you know, 12 of Nigeria's 36 states have Islamic law, have Sharia law, at least on the books.
Right.
Now, that scared a lot of people in the late 90s and early 2000s when those laws came into place.
Right.
But ask most Nigerian Muslims who I've spoken to will say, listen, the legacy is total corruption.
Right.
And so we're looking to other models. So,
and just to interject, I feel like it's a little bit more about, it's about stability and it's about some kind of law in a place where the state is weak and where there are not many, there's no social safety net, there's no economic stability. And so Sharia law is a type of law, which is therefore an advantage over the sort of the vacuum and the corruption. And so I think it's very important to contextualize that as not something that's sort of extremist overtly, although it is sort of in practice. It's in referent to, you know, the climate of lawlessness and a sense of decentralized sort of instability, sort of preferable for a lot of folks who are Muslim or not.
Absolutely. And I mean, to understand what makes Sharia attractive, I mean, Sharia has largely failed. I mean, the dirty secret is that it's made very little difference. I mean, from a purely economic standpoint, many Nigerian Muslims like Sharia because, let's say you have a court case in Nigeria. Well, that means a 12-year wait at a minimum for that case to come into the courts. Meanwhile, you're going to be paying a lawyer. You're going to be bribing the judge. I mean, the culture of corruption in a country in which an average from $4 to $8 billion are embezzled annually by government employees, that's a Human Rights Watch figure, is such that people look to any alternative to corruption. And religion, although, you know, it's much more complex when that adoption happens, on the surface of it, religion looks like it will guarantee a set of morals and ethics that will really balance really fight against, actually, that corruption, which is seen as largely inherited from a colonial model.
Well, I mean, I don't know how much I really put stock in that. Obviously, the system of patronage and the system of favoritism that the British and many other colonial powers enacted in various countries in Southern Africa it has contributed to this. But I've often been interested in this. I'd be curious to hear your take on this. The idea of clan and the idea of decentralized ethnic or religious affiliation is also an enormous component of the culture. Certainly Nigeria and other parts of Africa where, okay, so there's no electricity, but rather than engaging in collective civic democratic action, everyone buys a generator for their compound. Instead of dealing with the problem of corruption on a sort of macroscopic level from a government-wide framework, people sort of just participate in it insofar as they can advantage those people who are closest to them. So I wonder in what sense politics in Nigeria are forever going to be hampered by this idea that, you know, you're in it for your clan, you're in it for the people who are in your locality, you're in it for people who share your religious affiliation, and there is no state. The nation state in Africa is something that isn't sort of natural. I hesitate to use that word because it's very fraught, but it isn't something that's endemic in the way that the culture sort of understands civilization and society. The idea of having, you know, democratic institutions that provide a social safety net is not familiar necessarily. And while the colonial model sort of imported it in a way that has had long-lasting effects, it doesn't seem to be sort of a big part of it. I think that's sort of gives Nigeria and other countries an advantage because I do think, you know, in terms of development economics, decentralization, non-state actors will be key to, you know, whatever renaissance might be forthcoming, but still sort of remains a problem for the issue of politics and the issue of moving a country forward to democratic rule.
Mm-hmm. No, I think you make a lot of good points there. I mean, the deal with the nation state in most contemporary African nations is that it doesn't exist, right? They come from, as we well know, lines drawn on colonial maps that made little to any sense. To expect people to adopt them as somehow their own is ridiculous.
What can the U.S. do?
I mean, it's a difficult one in a thousand different ways. You know, do people look to collective solutions or do they go by the generator? Well, that's hard to know. I actually just got off the phone. I was talking to a woman named Molly Melkling who works in Senegal. And to take us slightly off the point, but not too far, Senegal just declared a nationwide effort to end female genital cutting in February. Now, the way that that began was that it was not possible to address the idea of FGC, as they call it, in a single village at a single time, because
it took federal.
The whole reality is interconnectedness. If one village is going to start, like if one village doesn't have electricity, right, or if one village claims the right to the land or wants to, you know, put their daughters through this ceremony, that any effort at change will fail unless it's interconnected, because
right.
in terms of intermarriage, in terms of any kind of collective experience, there has to be an interlinked effort, right? And so I don't know.
With respect to Senegal, though, Senegal has certain advantages with respect to all this, in that it's a country that's 94% Muslim. There's a certain, obviously there's ethnic differences, but in terms of the religion, it's a fairly homogenous environment where perhaps there is more, and again, it's more stable sort of politically. It's only 10 million people. I mean, Nigeria is, I think that 140 million figure is estimated. But they have certain advantages in terms of their ethnic and religious makeup and their population and the stability of democratic institutions and the successful transfer of power and fairly close relationship, certainly in an economic level, with France in terms of their currency being pegged to it. And so there are differences there. I guess my big concern, and this is something we wanted to talk about, is whether or not this violence, the sort of consistent tension between ethnic and religious groups in Nigeria means that the state falls apart. And obviously, you know, a huge, the backstory, I guess, in this contemporary moment is that, you know, the president has been out of the country for months. He hasn't addressed the people of Nigeria since November of last year. There's been a host of speculation about whether or not he is someone who can actually, you know, govern the country in future. His vice president, Jonathan Goodluck, has been empowered to act as the president and yet is sort of also a sort of weak political figure, doesn't have a strong political base. And so I just wonder whether the fractiousness of the Nigerian population will allow it to persist as a contiguous state. Obviously, I would hope so, but it's a big mess right now.
Sure.
I just don't know whether.
Well, that's been
been
a question since the 90s. I mean, when this violence really began to kick off after 99, right, after the end of military rule, mm-hmm. there were lots of sort of American analysts. I mean, it was a big CIA question, like, well, is this religious divide going to rip this country in two? I don't think so. I really don't. I mean, Nigeria is so, so riddled with problems, and like so many oil states, you know, being America's fifth largest supplier of oil, oil is a curse, right? And it's a curse where this money goes nationwide. And I think that so it's a federal system of distributing, although the oil wealth is primarily in the south, the way that that Nigeria has, and I think it's actually a good idea in principle, has basically balanced the inequalities between north and south in terms of resources, is to distribute oil money federally. So
right.
each of Nigeria's 36 states gets
right.
it, I mean, in different proportions. But so I think that,
I mean, this
I think Nigeria is going to stand as a single state. I mean, do I think that either Jonathan Goodluck or President Yar'Adua are strong leaders? No, I don't.
Right.
But I don't think that for most Nigerians, the nature of their federal leadership has anything to do with their daily lives. Now,
exactly.
You were speaking before we started, Dayo, about the role of the First Lady.
Right.
And I wanted to get to that and ask you a little bit more about what you were thinking.
Well, I mean, what's been fascinating to me is this this woman who is the wife of this very ill president has been sort of running the show since his illness really became a problem. And it's a little bit of an Eleanor Roosevelt deal where she is issuing the press releases. She's controlling the circle of influence, the people who are around him. And when they arrive back in Nigeria after his long sojourn in Saudi Arabia, she issued mm-hmm. a press release saying, you know, we thank those who have taken, you know, power for their services, almost as a way of saying, okay, let's forget that this whole power transfer had occurred and my husband is still, you know, the premier here. And
I
think it's interesting just in the context of sort of women's political empowerment in Africa in general. But I think, you know, she doesn't deserve a lot of the sort of gossipy. I mean, obviously it's very tawdry and it's almost soap operatic in the way that this drama has played out. But I think that, you know, it's difficult in this sort of crisis where there's been a power vacuum to sort of have anyone step in. You know, people are really looking for that. And I think it's been admirable, the sort of the step she's taken, despite them being a little melodramatic.
Sure. Sure.
But more broadly,
what do Nigerians in the diaspora what's their take? I mean, in terms of that was my take on the fact that I don't think this kind of violence or even the political vacuum is going to lead to a collapse of the state at a federal level. What are you hearing from people about how seriously they think that this violence will affect the larger political context of Nigeria?
Yeah. Look, I think people think that in crisis there's opportunity. Obviously, the issue of brain drain from countries like Nigeria has been a significant problem since the 1970s. You know, my parents got here in the 80s and thought they were going back. They didn't. They spent a lot of time there. My sister lives in Lagos now. And I just think, you know, the understanding that Nigeria is of critical strategic importance to places like the United States is very real. And the question of how, I mean, there have been places like, you know, the Nigerian Leadership Initiative is something that's sort of come out of not just this most recent violence, but since the December Christmas Day attempt with a young, wealthy, Muslim, fairly cosmopolitan Nigerian who, you know, I could easily, and I've spoke with Michelle Goldberg about this, someone who I can identify with in a certain sense, and that he's close to my age and that he's sort of diasporic, for lack of a better word. In the wake of this, there's been an understanding, and I've written about this, that the interconnectivity and the fact of globalization makes African democratic problems and problems with corruption and weak and failed states of central importance to people who are living in America. And Abdul Muttalib was sort of the first real understanding that this Middle Eastern problem that Americans have been sold with respect to the global war on terror is an African problem. It's a problem in Somalia. It's a problem certainly in Nigeria. And the question is really whether or not, and maybe you can speak to this, the type of religious extremism that led to the violence that we saw in Jos is an analog to the type of religious extremism that might have led Abdul Muttalib to try and travel to Yemen to get explosives and to partner with Al-Qaeda. I don't see those connections, but I'd be curious because, again, this
They're
is
not.
Something that...
Yeah, no, that's that was a my really take. Good point. They're not connected. I mean, to the extent that, you know, when I was in Nigeria one recent trip, I got in the middle of some bad. I mean, I was I had an encounter with this group that calls itself the Taliban, right?
Boko Haram.
And you know, these guys are, and having you know reported on the Taliban and interviewed the Afghan Taliban, this is the use of a global name to try to kind of hold on to a global source of power, but. I really, you know, when people talk about Saudi funding or Iranian funding in Nigeria in particular, I usually roll my eyes a little bit. Doesn't mean it doesn't happen, and there is a huge movement among, let's say it's not huge in terms of numbers, but it's extremely powerful among Nigerian, young Nigerian Muslims in the north. They call themselves the Shia. They call themselves Shia because they go on scholarships to Iran. And the idea, I mean, I was in Nigeria during the war with Hezbollah, and Hezbollah TV was on every station. Mm-hmm. I mean, partly because there is a Lebanese diaspora community northern Nigeria, but partly because Nigerian Muslims identify with any kind of embattled position, in the Muslim world. That is true.
And that's true across the Muslim world. That's right.
In terms of actual, that kind of militancy, that kind of powerful militancy, high-level militancy, having too much traction in Nigeria, no. No.
Yeah, and I think that it's also, if you look at,
then the question becomes, what is the nature, what kind of militancy, are we naive with what we fear? I mean, do we fear, you know, I fear, you know, high-level English, Arabic, highly educated young men who, you know, have access to different worlds? Or is it just as frightening to think about large-scale movements that see themselves as militant, even though they're not going to have a global reach directly to us?
Yeah, and I think, you know, my sort of recent understanding and reporting about the sort of question of, you know, the National Counterterrorism Center, the CIA, the NSA, and the Justice Department and the Defense Department prosecuting from the American side this war on terror really suggests that the Taliban is not a global. I mean, these are people who are, as you say, sort of appropriating a brand. And, you know, I would just also, as a counterpoint, point to some, I mean, religious fervor, I wouldn't even call it extremism, is ever present in Nigeria, whether it's a Christian or Muslim or other type of religion. And so that sure, really does for sure. me discount the sense that this is some sort of specifically Islamist type of violence that we're seeing. So that would just be my subpoint. But more generally, I just, you know, I do not think that there is really an affiliation, not from the perspective of some of the folks that I've talked to who are working closely on these issues. There isn't a sense that, you know, they need to worry very much about what's happening in Jos. But again, the question really becomes what are the sort of circumstances, what is the chemical mix, you know, in terms of politics, economics, and society that produces terrorists? I mean, again, Abdulmutallab was sort of a scary sort of new component to the question, but you know, you have this Jihad Jane character who's an American, blonde and green-eyed, who is working closely over the internet, that big scary entity that's causing trouble for prosecution of this war on terror, on, you know, making an attack on American soil. So I find that globalization sort of makes the war more difficult to prosecute, and I know the Obama administration has stopped calling it a war. It's also sort of comforting in that these people are sort of isolated cells that have access to the ideologies, but not necessarily the tools of destruction that we saw, you know, in the 90s and before 9/11.
Yeah, no, just to return to the question of militancy for a minute, I mean, one thing that I have noticed in these years of reporting on religious militancy in Africa in particular, and also South Asia, in communities, like, whoever is the minority tends to be prone especially to violence. And in Nigeria, especially along this belt, it's frequently the Christians. So we're looking at a longstanding history of attacks and counterattacks that represent, you know, people who seize to the identity of, I am part of an embattled minority and I will do whatever it takes to strike back. And I think that's where religious identity becomes more problematic, because it allows for people to seize on violence in the name of God, but really they're protecting their minority interests. And then with that minority interest comes a long history of rage. I think we are drawing to the end of our time. Am I correct?
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm fascinated by the overlay of economic mobility and all of this. I mean, it was a huge part. Sure. Even things like whale oil in the American slave trade are fascinating to me. And the sort of the things that we don't notice that produce, again, this chemistry where you have, you know, people who are young, people who are disenfranchised, people who happen to be part of an ethnic or religious minority, and people who have new access to technologies and conversations that would not have been the case, you know, 10, 15, 30, 50 years ago, are now empowered in a way that they can challenge states. And that's what we saw in 9/11, where you had a small group of people, under 20, radically change the entire geopolitical and geostrategic framework of the biggest country in the world. And so that's something that will be essential to sort of discussing as increasingly, and I've been very fascinated by the rise of technologies, whether they're internet-related or otherwise, in sub-Saharan Africa from east to west. And I think it's something that is under-discussed in terms of American strategy, but with luck, will start to become something that they do focus on, because I genuinely think it's a blind spot.
Well, I mean, let's return to something that you said that I think is absolutely talk about under-discussed, is that half of Nigeria's population is under 18, right?
Yeah.
So when this violence happens, I mean, that's the root. We've got to address that. I mean, if as an international community we have some responsibility to Nigeria, I would argue that it begins with the question of Nigeria's youth. I mean, again, that means 70 million young people with almost no access to education whatsoever and very little access to jobs if they do get that education in the first place. And the way that much of this violence works is that this is the very group, I mean, for example, you know, when I was in Maiduguri in the north, among these, the way that Islamic education works in Nigeria is that the kids travel, they go to madrasas, but they go to these itinerant teachers that are called El Majri. And what happens, it used to be that these teachers, that the teachers lived on farms, and so school is free, but that the kids were able to pay for school with their work on the farms. Well, partly as a result of climate change and the growing spread of the Sahara Desert, which is reaching into North Africa and reaching into Nigeria, these teachers have moved to the edges of slums. So this is about, I mean, this is at least 20 million Nigerian youth alone, although this itinerant Islamic education happens in most of West Africa. These guys have no school. Now they go to these teachers. They learn nothing but sort of a loose understanding of the Quran. And how do they make money for their teachers? They beg.
Right. And at the same time, you have this Boko Haram idea. Which is,
I'm sorry?
At the same time, you have this idea of Boko Haram, which is explicitly against Western education. That is also sort of a dangerous chemical to add to this mix, where it's not just that the educational system is eroding and Islamist education is increasing, but that there is a group of people who are also young, somewhat violent at times, and are specifically against the idea of educating young people in Western style, you know, what we would understand as sort of civic, general liberal arts.
I don't even think, you know, Dio, having been in, because I've done a lot of work on these El Majri kids that Boko Haram comes out of. I don't even think they are. I mean, they are so indoctrinated. Like, what happens is these basically become gangs, right? These schools become gangs. And these guys, are they against Western education? They don't even know what Western education means. You know, they are. What happens is they're in the employ in violence like what we're seeing in Jos, or violence like what we see in Boko Haram. And these smaller scale explosions in Nigeria are usually paid for, and they are paid for some political hootie-hoo who wants to win an election by any means necessary, because that is the way that elections
work
in Nigeria. So if one wants to look at the nexus of politics, economy, and what jobless youth, or these, who are these, you know, faceless 70 million kids, this is where they all come together in moments of isolated violence. And that, you know, as someone who has an interest in social justice, that to me, beginning with the questions of education in Nigeria, it is really tantamount. And, you know, I would ask you, I wonder what you have seen or what you have heard about Nigerian education. What's your sense of, I mean, the schools that I have seen working the best, although they aren't necessarily schools to which I would want to send my own kids, are private Christian conservative universities that are expensive and pretty successful. So what's your take on contemporary education in Nigeria, and how do you think it plays into the larger political crisis? Mm-hmm.
Look, I think the Nigerian universities that educated my parents, that were, you know, my extended family still works. A lot of them are educators at these universities, used to be top notch. I mean, these are places where kids went and learned, where at the time where there were resources, where there were good teachers before brain drain happened. And there's increasingly, I mean, there's a confederation of five universities in Parharpur and in Abuja, two in Lagos, and in Ibadan, that are all part of this Nigerian Higher Education Foundation that is really trying to make an effort to expand capacity in a way that they can produce, you know, critical. I mean, half of these schools are on strike for most of the year, where the teachers are sort of not well-versed. Even if they're whip-smart, you know, engineers, they don't have the sort of resources, they don't have the equipment, they don't have the capacity to educate and to become international centers of learning for, you know, within regions or within countries. And I think that that's an absolute shame. And I do know that there are folks who are, and this is, again, a huge part of my critique of sort of distaste with what Dambisa Moyo has been talking about with respect to aid. It's not that the aid is a problem. It's the allocation and the corruption that's a problem. Yeah. If a government accepting money from a foreign power such as the United States were able to prioritize education and get the computers and get the diagnostic tools for the medical schools and get the books or get, you know, whatever the generation of learning materials are to these schools, we wouldn't really have such a problem, right? We would have more human capital, and we would have greater sort of, you know, intellectual and some of these soft powers that people discuss in terms of influencing nations and cultures. So it's not really about starving the beast, as Moyo sort of advocates, but it's about making a priority. And it's not just about sort of profiteering and capitalism and looking out for your own, but about the actual, you know, the type of human capital that sort of doesn't go away, which is education. So I'm hopeful, but it really does require, and far be it for you, Ajwa, or good luck to really emphasize this in this climate.
I think that the few really important things to understand in terms of understanding Nigeria today is, first of all, I mean, you know, one reason it's so much fun to report from Nigeria is that the level of sophistication, firsthand sophistication from Nigerians on their specific context and their larger geopolitical context is absolutely singular. And in that way, I think really behooves us to pay attention to Nigeria, not only because of its huge population size and its oil wealth, but because I do think it's a harbinger of things to come in Africa in general. So, I hear you on education. I think that I absolutely think that that is really the key to changing things in Nigeria, because, I mean, there's the education, there's a level of corruption that absolutely boggles the mind. I mean, $4 to $8 billion a year embezzled by the government itself.
Right.
You know, and why? I mean, to be honest, would I too embezzle if I thought 3 years from now that my family might be totally out, there'd be nothing else to... I mean, that...
We would too.
I've certainly seen that in Somalia as well. It's like, sure, you guys can talk a lot about investment and cleaning up corruption, but until we have a stake in this country and this government ourselves, or it has some stability that we're going to be around, why should we? Why should we not just put the money in a Swiss
bank
account
and get the hell out of
here? There's
no incentive to behave correctly. I also think one other thing, and I did a review of Michelle Goldberg's new book, The Means of Reproduction, which I assume that you've looked at it or read. And women, empowering women, just to go back to Tarai Arajua and her Eleanor Roosevelt move. And the women who have been successful in Nigerian politics and African politics generally, that is so essential. I mean, I was, Bill Clinton said this at the CGI this year. It was just, it's the single most simple, basic thing you can do is to empower women to sort of take control over their specific, family circumstances and empower
Absolutely.
Them largely within the sort of economy and the society at large. It's so simple. It's not too difficult. Obviously, you're fighting against the winds of sort of prevailing cultural prejudices, but it's just such an obvious solution and dramatically increases the GDP, of localities and of nations and regions where women are ascendant, where women are working, where women are able to have fewer children, where women are able to control their reproductive health. And it's just such an obvious thing that I would certainly hope that Nigeria sort of, and other nations sort of take that to heart.
No, absolutely. And just, I mean, talking about, the question of buy-in, I mean, women have a cultural and just sociological buy-in before the game begins. They're not going anywhere. So they've got kids, and those kids are part of a larger culture, and they will work on that culture in a way that it simply isn't the same for men. And I definitely think that's something we're starting to recognize, and obviously Africans themselves have long known. Okay, so we're going to wrap it up. And
yes.
Dial, last thoughts on how for people who know jack about Nigeria and are looking at this violence, what do you think would be three salient points for them to understand in the context of it?
It's the same sort of thing you see in America. It's not that unfamiliar to see people who have very, very little social mobility, who have very, very little economic strength, who have very, very few options with respect to what they can do with their lives. It's quite easy to see them falling into cycles of violence and dysfunctional behavior, whether or not it's religiously motivated. These are young people who are at risk, and I think that a lot of the same policy solutions that people are formulating in the States are extremely relevant to here, obviously with the different sort of ethnic and cultural context. This is not an unfamiliar story, and I think people should really understand that. Children killing children is nothing new in America. So I think people should really examine some of the root causes of this and try and find ways of understanding.
Yeah, no, that sounds, that makes a lot of sense to me. So corruption, education, and having Americans and Western interests who are super interested in Nigeria. Why? Mm-hmm. I mean, the State Department's called it the most important country in Africa to the United States. Why? Oil. But is oil the main issue for facing Nigeria today? No, it's not. I would say it's education and corruption.
Right. And the renewable resources, people, which Nigeria has in abundance, as we discussed.
Absolutely. And I look forward to talking to you again under the aegis of Blogging Heads or somewhere else, Io, and I'm actually headed to D.C. tomorrow, so I hope to see you there.
Oh, marvelous. Well, it was a pleasure, Eliza. Good to meet again. now that I'm a little taller, and I hope everyone enjoyed hearing this chat. I really appreciate your insights, and congrats again on the book.
Great. Okay, thanks a lot.
Yep.
Bye-bye.